Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is religious scholar Todd Green. Todd is Associate Professor of Religion at Luther College in Decorah. He's author of a couple of books. In 2015, he came out with a book, The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West. His latest book, from 2018, Presumed Guilty, Why We Shouldn't Ask Muslims to Condemn Terrorism. Todd will be speaking in Cedar Rapids next Tuesday, April 2nd, at Coe College at 7 p.m. It's open to the public. He's doing this at the request of a group of organizations in Cedar Rapids, including the Christ Episcopal Church, Coe College, Cornell College, the First Lutheran Church, the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. There are several here. I'm just naming a few. The Islamic Center, the Mother Mosque of America, Mount Mercy University, Prayer Woods, among those who requested his talk. Todd Green, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Your questions this half hour about attitudes toward Muslims in this country. Also, we want to explore the connections between rhetoric, heated rhetoric, and violence in our country, in the world. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Todd, let's start off with the attack on the two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, more than 10 days ago. The killing of 50 people and the suspect charged seems to have been motivated by white supremacist beliefs. Do you see the tie between the motives of the attacker and what you call Islamophobia?
I do, at least based upon the perpetrator's own stated motives as he published in his manifesto. And certainly we should always view a manifesto like that through a critical eye, but it does fit. It fits actually larger patterns even of similar kinds of violence in which angry white men in the past decade have targeted religious and racial minorities out of this perception that they pose some sort of threat to white identity or white Western civilization. So to that extent, New Zealand is not some sort of outlying event, but it's the latest of a string of attacks. If you think about Anders Breivik, of course, in Norway, who was motivated by similar beliefs, but targeted young youth at a labor camp, Labor Party camp. But also particularly these attacks on houses of worship, Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and six African American Christians in Charleston. Jews in Pittsburgh last year, and then of course the Quebec City mosque shootings, and now this one in Christchurch. That what they all share in common: angry white men, fearing some sort of takeover from immigrants or Muslims or other racial or religious minorities, or some sort of loss of white culture identity, and they take matters into their own hands and they commit horrific violence. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand this attack in that regard.
As I go through just in my mind the list that you gave us there of this type of violence against religious minorities, that's all within the last 10 or 20 years, is that right?
Yeah, all of that dates back slightly less than a decade, 2011 onward, basically. This is a trend.
Okay, so if you're going to put 2011 as a point of reference, what happened? Why that point? Why that departure? Why that uptick in violence against religious minorities?
Well, a couple of reasons. One would be the rise of far-right rhetoric and far-right politicians who oftentimes promote these views of Muslims as the other, as alien, as foreign, as a threat to Western civilization. And we've seen these far-right parties, particularly in Europe, but you see them in other Western nations as well, on the rise for the past couple of decades and really gaining strength in the past decade. So that's one reason in terms of the background of this. 2010 was also a big turning point, I think, here in the United States, particularly because of what at the time was called the Ground Zero Mosque controversy, you might remember, this controversy over the possible building of an Islamic center in Lower Manhattan, not far from where the World Trade Center stood. That's really when a group of anti-Muslim organizations and prominent anti-Muslim figures started to gain a lot of public influence and power over how Muslims and Islam were talked about and framed in public discourse. And they got more media attention. They also started to gain more political influence as well, and that influence has only increased in the past decade. And then we see another turning point in 2015 and 2016 where some of these violent attacks have been taking place from that year onward. And that's, of course, the last presidential election cycle here in the United States and some other election cycles abroad in Europe, where anti-Muslim rhetoric really became an all-time high, where we had candidates here in the United States who were talking about patrolling Muslim neighborhoods, flirting with Muslim ID cards and Muslim registration systems. And one candidate, of course, who talked about Islam hating us and who proposed a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the country. And Ben, we didn't have that kind of rhetoric in any kind of explicit way in 2004 or even 2008. We had some of it, and we had the whole Obama is a Muslim sort of conspiracy theory, but it's become more and more overt. And the more overt it's become, the more we see this contributing to cultures of hostility and hatred toward Muslims, and the more we're starting to see now violence emanating from that in some instances.
Of course, the candidate you mentioned became president, is our current president. And and back to the New Zealand attack of a few days ago, that manifesto purportedly written by the suspect calls our president, quote, a symbol of renewed white identity. What do you make of these charges? The White House has certainly pushed back against that. But what do you make of the charges against the president and his response to the massacre and to this criticism?
Well, the fact is that there are a lot of white nationalist, white supremacist groups, including the KKK, who, if we remember, actually endorsed Trump back during the election, that do see him in a similar vein as the perpetrator of the New Zealand attacks, as a symbol of white identity, as someone who's speaking out against political correctness. And so white nationalism and certain segments of Trump supporters really are intertwined very much, and so we do have to take that seriously. And Trump's response didn't surprise me that he's going to downplay the threat of white nationalism or white supremacy. I should add, though, Ben, he's not the only one who's done that. Peter King, a representative from New York State, back in 2011-2012 was holding radicalization hearings about Muslims right in Congress. And whenever he would be pressed on the rise of right-wing violence or white supremacist violence, he too would also downplay it. So this is a systemic issue, and it exists not just in one politician, but in the political system as a whole in terms of where its resources are directed and where its energy is directed. In Trump's case, though, speaking too harshly about white supremacy, I think he probably fears might undermine some support in certain segments of his base that he's trying to maintain. So he's not going to talk much about it. But had the perpetrator been a Muslim, we'd still be hearing about it.
Todd Green is with us this half hour. If you've just joined us, Associate Professor of Religion at Luther College. In the title of your 2015 book, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West, you use this word, Islamophobia. A phobia we know as an extreme or irrational fear or an aversion to something. And I'm wondering, because I think it may be, at least correct me if I'm wrong, sort of an inexact term. There are phobias that are largely irrational. Arachnophobia, fear of spiders. Of course, tens of thousands of spiders species on the earth, less than 1% are dangerous. But there is reason to be wary of spiders. But there are also phobias that are completely irrational. I looked up arithmophobia, a fear of numbers. So which of these phobias would you say Islamophobia, as you say, is more like?
It's a good question, and you're raising this larger question, of course, of whether this is the best term to use for this, precisely because of the phobia piece.
Right.
And, the thing about Islamophobia is that there are elements to it that are actually completely irrational. For example, if you find yourself having this extreme fear of Muslims committing violence and terrorism in the United States, and you actually look at the data on this since 9/11, you're going to see that Muslims are not a particular source of violence. In fact, you're much more likely to, be killed by your own furniture moving it than you would by a Muslim extremist, right? But this fear that we have towards Muslims is not in proportion to reality. But that being said, there's a lot of Islamophobia that's also intentionally manufactured, and that it does have a strategy to it, which kind of puts it outside this irrational phobia category. A lot of the rhetoric we saw in the last election cycle, for example, that I talked about a while ago, I don't think then-candidate Donald Trump was just, you know, talking unfiltered. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. He was trying to manufacture fear and tap into this anxiety that exists in segments of the larger population in order to galvanize voters and to leverage political support, and it worked. But he knew what he was doing, right? Mm-hmm. So there is something to that that we have to take seriously as well.
Right. If there's an exaggerated level of fear towards Islam, fundamentalist Islam, what is the appropriate level of fear in your view?
Well, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I think Muslims, like every other religious community, should be presumed innocent, right? Should be treated and given the benefit of the doubt. There is no reason to have a heightened fear of Muslim Americans, and there's nothing behind that. I think 9/11 certainly gives people the impression that there should be. But when you think about who those perpetrators were and where they came from and how much of that event, as horrible as it was really an anomaly. It hasn't been the norm to have those kinds of attacks, right? And there is a history to those attacks, and there's political factors that drove those attacks that we need to pay more attention to as well, to explain them at least, not to justify them, of course. Then you're going to start to recognize that there really isn't much reason. There is no reason, really, to have a heightened fear of Muslims. What I talk about in the book I wrote last year, The Presumed Guilty, is that in many ways our fixation on Muslims and terrorism and Muslims and violence oftentimes functions as a distraction from the rest of us. There is a very, very long history in the United States of white Americans and white Christian Americans promoting some horrific and participating in some horrific episodes of violence. But it's a history that we don't talk much about and that we don't commemorate much. And for that reason, there's this perception that Muslims are a particular source of danger, when in fact, the kinds of violence that we fear from Muslims in many ways is violence that we, and by we, quote-unquote we, I mean white Americans and white Christian Americans, have themselves been much greater perpetrators of throughout history.
Todd Green with me of Luther College, where he's an associate professor of religion. That latest book, Presumed Guilty, you mentioned, the subtitle, Why We Shouldn't Ask Muslims to Condemn Terrorism. Why shouldn't we ask? Why shouldn't Muslims be asked to condemn terrorism carried out in the name of Islam?
Well, there are three reasons I think we should not ask this question of Muslims. The first one being that when you read any scholarship that actually studies terrorism and the motives of terrorists and has done interviews with terrorists, you find the same conclusion in most of these studies, that Islam is not the driving force behind the terrorist attacks. And oftentimes it's political and social factors that are the catalyst, really. And Islam perhaps gets instrumentalized in this violence, but it's not the source or the start of the violence. So that's one reason we shouldn't. The second reason is that Muslims condemn terrorism all the time. Muslim condemnations of terrorism are ubiquitous, and they're not particularly difficult to find. And so if there's someone listening to this program today and they're saying to themselves, but I've never heard this. I've never heard Muslims condemn terrorism. Mm-hmm. I mean, the more difficult question you have to ask yourself is why you haven't. Because it's not because Muslims haven't done it. It's not because this hasn't been published on the internet or in newspapers. So the reasons fall on the rest of us for trying to figure out why we are not attuned to this. And third and finally, the reason I just gave a while ago is that I find that asking Muslims to condemn terrorism is a question predicated on a guilt by association mentality that would not apply to me, where Muslims are all collectively guilty of violence committed by a very small number of people. And in doing so, we project onto Muslims our own anxieties about unresolved histories of violence that we don't want to talk about. So it's a distraction. Mm-hmm. It is really a distraction, asking Muslims to condemn terrorism, yet you have yet to ask me whether I condemn what happened in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. You know, and so why is that? I'm not saying you should. I mean, but you presumed that I would be condemning that attack no matter what, right? Mm-hmm. But would Muslims be given the same benefit of the doubt had the perpetrator been Muslim? And that's the double standard. That's the hypocrisy, and that hypocrisy is behind a larger effort to distract us from dealing with our own violent past and our ongoing complicity in a violent world order today.
I wanted to help our audience understand, to the extent that they don't, of course, Muslims listening as well, about American Muslim beliefs compared to the rest of the world, Muslims in the rest of the world. According to what I've gathered this morning, there are nearly 2 billion Muslims in the world, roughly a quarter of the global population. Mm-hmm. Islam, the world's second largest religion after Christianity, but the fastest growing major religion. A majority of Muslims live in the Asia-Pacific region. Here in the U.S., 3 to 4 million Muslims, just over, I guess, 1% of the population. So what are the key ways in which beliefs of American Muslims are different than the majority of Muslims outside of the U.S.?
It's an understandable question, but a hard one to answer, in part because even for Muslims outside so-called Western nations, their beliefs can be quite diverse. Muslims who live in Albania or Bosnia might have very different ways of understanding Islam than Muslims who live in Saudi Arabia, who would have different ways maybe of understanding Islam or the cultural practices surrounding it than Muslims living in Malaysia. So there's a lot of diversity in Muslim populations even outside the West, not to mention inside the West. To me, the big difference is really simply where Muslims are in terms of whether they're in the majority or the minority. And obviously in the United States and in many European, Western European countries, Muslims are in minority communities. And being in the minority, whether you're a Muslim in the minority or a Christian in the minority or a Jew in the minority or a Buddhist in the minority, certainly shapes the way you have to articulate your faith, and to do it in a way that doesn't set the majority population off, either in terms of discriminatory policies or in some cases, as we now know, violence. But in terms of what Muslims in America believe versus Malaysia or something, it's a very difficult question to answer because Muslims are so incredibly diverse, mm-hmm. even within America.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to ask some questions that I think, you know, our spectrum of audience members would like to have asked. Because we have so much coverage of Sharia law, the jihad war, I wonder if you can answer this question. To what extent do Muslims, for instance, in the U.S., believe in such things as Sharia law or jihad war against unbelievers?
There is no data that suggests that Muslims in some sort of collective sense in America believe in a jihad war against America. The very understanding of the concept of jihad is also a very nuanced, complex one within Islam, and there are many different ways to understand jihad, including an inner spiritual struggle to sort of battle your own internal demons, if you will, and that a lot of Muslims embrace. So we have to recognize that. In terms of Sharia, I always see these debates about and these anxieties about Sharia in the United States as really weapons that have very little to do with how Muslims themselves would understand Sharia. Sharia, broadly speaking, is mainly in Islam an understanding of God's blueprint for the world, how God wants people to live in terms of their relationships with their fellow human being, how God wants people to worship, right? So Sharia is a very broad concept, you know, God's will for humankind, which is slightly different from Islamic law, which is the human effort to interpret it, what we might call in Western legal jargon jurisprudence. And so that's its own complicated history with various schools of thought that in terms of where those schools of thought are located around the world, you know, is quite diverse. But Muslims themselves have very diverse understandings of Sharia. By doing ablution to prepare for prayer, you're following Sharia in a very broad sense. By helping your neighbors with charity or with acts of compassion, that's following Sharia. So there's nothing inherently about this broader concept of Sharia that's in any way antithetical to American law, and not to mention that the Constitution itself is set up in a way that anyone can follow the legal precepts of their religion, Jews, Catholics, Muslims, so long as they don't contradict the Constitution or trump the Constitution. And if they do, the Constitution wins out. And we have zero evidence that Muslims are doing anything that's trumping the U.S. Constitution any more than Jews or Catholics are. So it's really it's a war that's meant to terrify and generate anxiety. And there's been a lot of efforts to ban Sharia in various states of the United States. But it really is a way to stir up fear and anxiety and hostility towards Muslims that's divorced from how Muslims actually understand Sharia and live out their own religion.
A few more minutes with Todd Green of Luther College, a religious scholar there, associate professor of religion. I want to get your reaction to, and I'm sure you're well acquainted with the Pew Research Center's surveys about Muslims and Islam. I wanted to just share a little bit from the Pew Center's survey conducted in 2017, which asked Americans to rate members of 9 religious groups on, quote, a feeling thermometer from 0 to 100, where 0 reflects the coldest, most negative possible rating, 100 the warmest, most positive rating. Now, overall, Americans gave Muslims an average rating of 48 degrees. right in the middle, but that's actually fairly cold when you look at the way other major religions are rated. They're in feeling thermometer terms. The 48 degrees is similar to the way Americans feel toward atheists. In other words, pretty cool. Also part of this survey, Republicans and those who lean toward the Republican Party gave Muslims an average rating of 39, even cooler than Democrats rating toward Muslims of 56. How do you explain that partisan difference?
Well, the partisan difference is all of it's unfortunate, of course, but some of this is a deliberate strategy by the Republican Party since 9/11, increasingly to use and instrumentalize Islamophobia to garner votes and to gain some leverage in the electorate. But it hasn't always been a part of the Republican strategy. According to exit polls in the year 2000, when George W. Bush ran against Al Gore, the majority of American Muslims actually voted for Bush. It was the last time the majority of Muslims voted for a Republican candidate. But that tells you just how much in 19 years or so has changed when it comes to the Republican Party and its relationship to Muslim Americans. And a lot of this has had to do with the war on terror, with foreign policy, with this need to sort of maintain a certain kind of brand with the Republican Party when it comes to being strong on terrorism. And targeting a minority religious community that's a very small percentage of the population, barely over 1%, and where there's not much much pushback you'll get when you do so. The Republican Party and the Trump-Pence re-election sites both last year had a questionnaire in which one of the questions was whether you think we should be concerned about Sharia, right? I mean, the non-existent problem I just told you about. But yet that's a serious question being asked on their questionnaires. So the Republican Party has done more to manufacture this fear and try to leverage it, and to some extent has been quite successful in doing so than the Democratic Party. But I will add briefly that the Democratic Party is not immune to Islamophobia, and we're starting to see these conversations had within the Democratic Party as we speak, including people like Rashida Tlaib and Representative Ilhan Omar, who have both raised the question about whether there is some more implicit anti-Muslim prejudice even amongst the Democratic leadership.
Mm, that's a whole nother discussion, Todd. Mm. You just opened another chapter. We don't have time to go into it. That means we'll have to have you back on the program. Thank you very much, Todd Green, Associate Professor of Religion at Luther College, author of Presumed Guilty, Why We Shouldn't Ask Muslims to Condemn Terrorism. That came out in 2018. Todd will be speaking in Cedar Rapids next Tuesday, April 2nd, at Coe College at 7 p.m. And Todd Green, thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
When we come back, Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University will be with us. She's author of the new book, Understanding How Women Vote: Gender Identity and Political Choices. That coming up in just a moment. We'll talk about the gender differences in candidates and how we vote. Kelly Winfrey has done a lot of original research on that topic. We'd love to have your questions. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer back in just a moment with more of River to River.